precepts, and I will define what the precepts are. And I did it because at Brightway Zen, for a lot of people who don't know, every spring we study the precepts for 11, 12, I don't know how many weeks. And we end that precept study with a ceremony called Jukai. And every spring, I was telling Donya this, it's time, it's going to study the precepts, and we're going to have Jukai. If you want to take Jukai, just come talk to me. We'll sign you up with Jukai. And now you got to read the Kyojukaimon. And I am convinced, in fact, I will bet on it, that there is always two or three people who have no idea what we're talking about. In fact, I am sure of it. And so the first thing I'm going to do is just give a bunch of definitions around what I just talked about so that everybody's on the same page when we do start. And you may recall last Tuesday night, Domyo was talking about the fundamentals of Buddhism, and that's the series that we're going through now. And I pointed out the fact that the precepts weren't on there. So we went back and forth a little bit about maybe they should, because they are pretty fundamental to Buddhist practice. They are certainly kind of fundamental to my practice. But the first thing I want to define is bodhisattva. And Tegan and Dan Layton has written a great book about bodhisattvas. It's called Faces of Compassion. And here's how he defines them. A bodhisattva is a being who carries out the work of the Buddhas, vowing not to personally settle into the salvation of final Buddhahood until she or he can assist all beings throughout the vast reaches of time and space to fully be free. A bodhisattva is a Buddha with her sleeves rolled up. And I loved that image. He is fond of pointing out possible bodhisattvas in our everyday life. He thinks that Bob Dylan is a bodhisattva of music and poetry. He identifies Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, as a bodhisattva because of the stand he took in terms of his own drafting to the Vietnam War. And when he talked about a bodhisattva is a Buddha with her sleeves rolled up, I couldn't help but think of Rosie the Riveter. And, you know, the hair tied up away from her face, the strong arm, you know, a bodhisattva of female capability and patriotism because the men were going off to the war, and work ethic because women need to really pitch in and do the work that needed to be done that could not be done because of the war. Probably the most common bodhisattva that we talk about is Avalokiteshvara, because we do the chant to her every Sunday morning in the Heart Sutra, and she is the bodhisattva of compassion. In China, she is known as Guanyin, and in Japan, she's known as Kanzan. And then I came across another definition, which I wanted to share because it's by Kosho Uchiyama, and we're reading Uchiyama in the book group. And he says a bodhisattva is an ordinary person who takes up a course in his or her life that moves in the direction of Buddha. You and I, actually, anyone who directs their attention, their life, to practicing the way of the life of a Buddha is a bodhisattva. And then he later goes on to say, you could also define a bodhisattva as one who acts as a true adult, setting the bar for me very high. So that's kind of what a bodhisattva is. It's an archetype. And then I wanted to say what the 16 bodhisattva precepts were. And these are a set of guidelines by which bodhisattvas live their lives. Some of them, the 10 grave precepts, they look just like the 10 commandments. No, they look an awful lot like the 10 commandments, but not really. But all I know is that in my own Christian upbringing, the Ten Commandments was something that we read about or talked about in Sunday school, but were not referred to ever again, or at least not to my memory. Whereas at Bright Way Zen and in many other Buddhist communities, we really revisit the precepts all the time. And for us, it's pretty intensely once a year in the spring. I don't know, some of you know that I have a 12-step background, so I don't know if I got this story from the 12 steps or from the precepts. But this, the image is of a being, the steel ball in the pinball machine, and you're going down the center, and then whammo, a flipper hits you, and you're way over on this side of the field where you don't want to be, and then wham, another one comes back and flips you toward the middle. And so it's precept, 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 keeping you down the middle, which is kind of a hard way to go. But it's not unlike the way I tackled them at first. Rev Anderson, and it's his book I'm reading, calls them a roadmap. But I can remember times when my parents would take us on field trips and, you know, Dad, you were supposed to take that exit. He says, why didn't you tell me the next exit's 20 miles down the road? So even with a roadmap right in front of you, you can get lost. And you can get lost in the precepts for sure. I also wanted to talk about what the Kyoju Kaimon was. The Kyoju Kaimon is a recitation that we do, and it's Dogen's essay. So Dogen is our ancestor who founded Soto Zen in Japan. And in your chant book, this chant book, it's on page 27, and I'm not going to read it, but during precept study time, we read it every single Tuesday evening. And when I first realized that I was going to take the precepts, I read the Kyoju Kaimon every single morning. And that was difficult because it's about 15 or 20 minutes long. Just so you'll know, we do get to reading it. When he describes the 10 grave precepts, there are two little paragraphs after each one, little tiny one-liner, two-liner paragraphs. The first paragraph is attributed to Bodhidharma, who brought Buddhism from India to China. The second paragraph is attributed to Dogen. So you'll see that under the 10 grave precepts. And then the last thing is Jukai, and that is the formal ceremony where you actually receive the precepts from Domyo. And you're not doing that alone. You might be the only one who's doing it this year. I hope not. But even so, the entire Sangha is there with you, going through the precepts with you as you do it. So it's a really big group thing. And I would argue that everybody has a different reason for why they decided to receive the precepts. And I found this very amusing today. I wish James Gregg was on the Zoom call with us, because I believe it was, I don't know if it was this morning or yesterday morning, he sent out a link to something that he was encouraging us to all read. And he went into a fair amount of detail about the things he had studied and this kind of Buddhism and that kind of Buddhism. And it was very clear to me in a short period of time that he had put a tremendous amount of thought into where he was going to study Buddhism and had gone to many different places. And he knows this much about this much Buddhism. And I know this much about this much Buddhism. And all I know is my approach was, you know, Bright Way Zen opened up a mile down the road, and I've been thinking about Buddhism, so I thought I would go and check it out. So his approach is perfectly fine and very scholarly, and my approach is not scholarly at all, but it's also perfectly fine. Because the end result is really, it's all good. And it's the same way with the precepts. I just don't think there's a wrong reason to take them. I really don't. I had been at Brightway Zen for a year. I noticed that there were people who wore Wakasus like I have. There were people who had Wagesas. Who has a Wagesa on tonight? Anybody? Nobody? Oh, Bob has his Wagesa. So when you take the precepts, you're given a gift. You're given a couple of things, but one of the things you get is a Wagesa, which is symbolism for a robe. The main thing I did before getting serious about the precepts is I wanted to make sure through Domio that if I did take the precepts and go through Jukai, that I could have a cheeseburger every now and then. And she confirmed that I could. The only thing I would say is that they are a vow. You are taking a vow for every single one of the precepts. And, you know, you need to have that level of reverence and respect for it. There needs to be some level of intention that you're going to try and keep them, even though they can be very difficult. If you had asked me back when I took the precepts, if you had told me that I was going to be talking about them, giving an overview of them, or that I would even present a precept to my Sangha, which I have done now 3 times, I would not have believed it. That's the way we study them at Brightway. Domio announces it to the people who have already taken Jukai, and this has been done. That email went out, and she asked people to sign up for a precept to present to the group. And to me, this is an outstanding way to study them. I have thought all year about the 6th precept, which is, it's the hardest one to remember. Do not dwell on past mistakes, which is really about gossip and judgment. But I've thought all year about that because last April I presented it, and it'll be the same thing this year coming up when I present the next thing I'm going to present. So one of my goals with this little high-level talk is to see if I can't inspire an Oklahoma land grab approach to more studied students grabbing a precept and I want that one. No, you take that one. My foot's on this one. I want that one kind of approach to presenting them. I hope that happens. A lot of us like to read outside of the Sangha on the precepts. And everybody knows I am a terrible typist and I can't type and read at the same time. You can't even see this. My very favorite book on the precepts is The Mind of Clover, and that's by Robert Aiken, A-I-T-K-E-N. Can somebody type that into the chat, Bob, maybe? Oh, John's going to do it. Thank you, John.
What was the title again?
Mind of Clover. Robert Aiken is from, I can't remember the name of the Sangha. Is it the Diamond Sangha? But he's in Hawaii, or was. He is my father's age, so he's dead now. But because he's my father's age, I kind of feel like I hear that kind of attitude and approach to life that my father, a World War II era person, would have had. And Robert Aiken is from that era. And he is also very humble and very quick to call on himself when he feels as though he needs to practice better or that he might have let the Sangha down. There's another one that a lot of, there you go. There's another one that a lot of people really appreciate because it's in plain English. Thank you, Bob. And it's called Waking Up to What You Do. And it's by Diane Rizzetto, R-I-Z-Z-E-T-O, Waking Up to What You Do. It's all about the precepts. Is someone's mic on? Somebody want to say something? The book I started reading, because I didn't know what precept I was going to do, and I just wanted to pick up another book to start reading about them, and maybe it would give me an idea. And so I read, this is not a new book, but it's new to me, and it's called Being Upright by Reb Anderson. K came out in early 2000s. And he really inspired me, actually, to give this talk tonight. And the last one I will recommend, somebody recommended this to me last year, and I read my precept in it. And that's, it's not a great way to approach a book on the precepts. You really got to read the whole thing. I started it again this year, and it is wonderful. And it's called Wholehearted, and it's by Paley Ellison, E-L-L-I-S-O-N. Yes, thank you. It's really great. Very warm, very everyday practice. So what inspired me was a chapter that Rev Anderson had early in the book on the precepts in general, and it's called The Two Teaching of the Two Truths, Truth with an S. And it was a description about how to approach the practice of the precepts. So how does anyone work with the precepts, and how do we approach them? Domyo talked last week about how do we wrestle with the fundamental teachings and what does it mean to work with them? First of all, you don't have to do them in order. You don't have to start with one and go through to the end. You can pick any one you want, and you will soon find out that this precept affects this one. And if you work this one, you're going to get this one. And the next thing you know, they're all kind of mushing together. So they are all encompassing. You can work them on the surface and be just fine. You can go really deep with them and be just fine too. And it's really a wonderful study. So I'm going to start with a little story about Yaoshan, which was in this chapter. And Yaoshan was a monk in around the 8th century in China, and his teacher was Shi Tu. And just so you'll know, Shi Tu wrote The Harmony of Difference and Sameness, which we sometimes recite on Sunday morning. And so Yaoshan is a monk, and he is trying so hard. He meditates, he works the precepts, he studies the Pali Canon, all the sutras, and he is in despair. He goes to Shi Tu and he says, I just understand that Zen is going to show me the essence of my mind and put me on the path to Buddhahood, but I just don't think I'm getting there. What am I doing wrong? And Shi Tu says, being just so won't do. Not being just so won't do. Being just so and not being just so won't do at all. How about you? And Yaoshan goes, huh? And Shi Tu says, you know, you might be better off to talking to my Dharma brother, Mazu. And so he sends Yaoshan off to find Mazu. And I don't know how long it takes him, but there's an implication in the story that there's been a lot more study going on Yaoshan's part by the time he finally meets Mazu, and he asks him the same question. I just understand that Zen Buddhism is supposed to really show me the essence of my mind and put me on the path of Buddhahood. Why is this not happening? And Mazu says, sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes I don't make him raise his eyebrows and blink. Sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is all right. And sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is not all right. How about you? And of course, we all know how the story ends. Yaoshan is immediately enlightened. And we'll get to that and why that is in a minute. But this to me is a story, at least in the beginning, of the conventional truth. That's one of the truths that Reb Anderson is describing in this story. Conventional truth is the world we walk around in every day. It's right and it's wrong. It's good and it's bad. It's pleasing or it's harsh. This is the world I'm pretty comfortable in, and it's the approach I took to the precepts. But Reb Anderson says, ultimately, we realize that practicing with a conventional dualistic perspective is one continuous mistake. And I would disagree. I would say that practicing with the conventional truth is still necessary. It's just not complete. But it's what many of us do. The conventional world has a lot of rules. It's got speed limits. It's got cops. It's got jobs to go to. It's got school to go to, tests to study for and pass. It has rules of decorum, which we are finding increasingly hard to follow in this day and age. It has bills to pay. That's the conventional truth. And I sometimes think, believe it or not, how beautiful life could be if I obeyed all the rules. Somebody was talking about this on the radio this morning about his mama had told him, if you work hard and obey all the rules, your life's going to be great. Unfortunately, life is just not that simple and straightforward. It has its ups and downs. But I have used the precepts myself to help me follow those rules and to learn how to follow them better. The conventional truth is often and almost always the point of departure that we take. It's been the way I've been practicing the precepts. The conventional truth is one of do this, don't do that. And it's almost as if the Kyoju Kaimon is asking you to come and practice in the conventional way, because it's do not kill, do not steal, do not lie, do not dwell on past mistakes, and so forth and so on. Why would Reb Anderson call practicing in this way one continuous mistake? And this is when I have to put in a plug for my favorite book. Everybody can guess what it is. Mark, can you guess what it is?
I was going to say Moon and a Dewdrop, but Why Buddhism is True. Okay.
Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. I love it. So why does, I highly recommend it. I can't recommend it enough. I've read it twice. I'm going to read it a third time. Why does Reb Anderson say that practicing in the conventional truth is one continuous mistake? It's because what I see and what I think and what I do and what I say is all filtered through a brain whose primary purpose is to look out for number one. And what I have learned in my Buddhist practice so far, which is not very long, is that my biggest problem is number one. In the conventional world, I work hard, I fail, I beat myself up, I try harder, I have to deal with my shortcomings, I develop anxiety, anger, depression. This is another definition of Jukai that comes from Diane Rossetto, and she wrote Waking Up to What You Do, which is one of the books I mentioned on the precepts. Jukai is made up of ju, which is receiving or granting, and kai is precepts. At a deeper level, ju means to open a space within the core of our being to what is natural and true. It is perhaps more like making a space in which the precepts can manifest as what is natural. So in the sense, ju is being open to what is, or what I would call open to the present moment. At a deeper level, Kai refers to the precepts not merely as rules that keep us straight on the path, but as signposts that point us toward naturally acting for the benefit of all beings. The way of the precepts is the path of going beyond the dream of self. It is the path that reveals the truth that our own happiness and well-being is intricately connected to the happiness and well-being of others. That is the ultimate truth. So why was Yoshan suddenly enlightened? It was because finally, after years of study, he was able to see the ultimate truth that everything I do is made possible only through my interdependence with all other people, all other animals, all other creatures, even dirt and rocks of the world. That is the ultimate truth. Dogen says to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. To be verified by all things is an understanding of my interdependence with everything. And notice that the first thing he says is to forget the self is to be verified. I don't have to do anything. I'm just going to sit here and try not to think, and I am verified by all things. Things come to me. The present moment comes to me. I don't have to go out and grab anything. And Domio said this last week, and I understood it in my head, but now, having thought about this a lot and read some more, I understand it even more deeply. In the space of the ultimate truth, the precepts practically work themselves. You really don't have to do anything. And this is where I think of a big black amoeba. And I know... I know, Sydney, one time you wondered out loud, what if we're all just a part of a one big amoeba? Well, the truth is that in session, that is what I think about. So when I'm in a session at Grey Vow, you know, they got this huge zendo, and particularly at Rohatsu in December, there's 50 or 60 people in it. We're all wearing really dark colors, and we look like one big black amoeba, and a bell rings, and we turn into a little line. The amoeba elongates. I think that's what they do. That's what I remember from science class. And then we all march down to the cafeteria, and we break into little parts, and we sit down and we eat lunch, and a bell rings, and then we all form a single line again, and we all march back, this black line, back into the zendo as one big amoeba. You know, the sessions I've been to are usually about 7 days long. And after you've been sitting next to people, the same person on the right and the same person on the left, I don't even know them, but they have meaning for me. And it's actually pretty emotional at the end of the session when I stand up to hug them goodbye, and I'm introducing myself to them because I probably never really talked to them. But their presence was very important to me. Their body warmth, if nothing else, because that zendo up at Great Vow is very cold. And when they shift around, I know they're uncomfortable like I am. And when they have to stand up because they just can't stand it anymore, they give me the permission to stand up and get a chair because it's just been too much for me at this point. How could I possibly be angry at them? How could I possibly hurt them in any way? Where is the interest in lying to them or judging them? So that is, to me, what the precepts working themselves for us, I think, is like. And I was talking to Demio about this, and I came up with an analogy of, you know, I'm in a parking lot outside of a crowded grocery store, and I see a woman walking out of the grocery store, and in one hand she's got her bag of groceries, and in the other hand she's got her toddler. And next thing you know, that bag splits open and groceries are going everywhere and it has started to rain. Who wouldn't help her? I would help her immediately. And Domio reminded me that that is my Buddha nature. And that is the ultimate truth. So the ultimate truth is really not that far away. In fact, as some of us know, we live and walk around in the conventional truth, and the ultimate truth is right here. We just can't always see it. In fact, most of the time, I'll admit, I can't. Reb Anderson says, we approach the ultimate meaning of the precepts not through the use of discriminating consciousness, not through our own personal power, not through clinging to myself. We realize the ultimate meaning by being upright and entering into awareness of our interdependence with all beings. That awareness is Buddha nature and its compassion. So whereas I thought I was working the precepts into my daily life and trying, they were helping me be a better person, what they're really teaching me is compassion. We're going to have lots of time for discussion. There's one more thing I wanted to add, another little definition. And he's talking about Dogen here. And he says, Dogen teaches that rigidly holding to the conventional understanding of the precepts violates the precepts. The compassionate approach is to respect the conventional truth in the context of non-attachment, never losing sight of the ultimate goal of the precepts. In fact, a bodhisattva sometimes finds it necessary to break a precept in the conventional sense in order to fulfill the compassionate purpose of his or her life. And that is called skillful means. That is a definition of skillful means. And another word for skillful means is compassion. And I'll just close with Reb Anderson's last paragraph in this chapter. The two truths are presented separately in order to promote understanding. But in practice, neither aspect is more or less important than the other. Each approach, when fully realized, completely includes the other. Those who have realized the ultimate meaning are still completely devoted to the conventional approach to the precepts. Realizing the ultimate is useless and even dangerous if you can't go back to the beginning and practice with everyone. In the end, the two truths are thoroughly integrated in the bodhisattva's heart by the practice of compassion. So that is my little introduction to the precepts, which after we go through the fundamental, see, I honestly thought we would start them in March, and here we are in mid-February, so I thought it would be a good tee up, but we're not really starting them until April, but that's okay. They are fundamental teachings, as well as all the other things that we and Domio will be talking about over the next few weeks. But I don't know about breakouts. Maybe we could all just hang out. And I'm getting a one thumbs up and a head nod, another thumbs up. Oh, good. Who wants breakouts? And I have some prompting questions we can talk about, but let's just see if we have questions first.
One of the things, Ken, I don't mean to put you on the spot, Jinri, but so I've been trying to like wrestle with each of the precepts. And one of the things that really set me on this journey was an article by Shohaku Okamura. And he mentioned, and I also know that Shinru Suzuki mentioned it a bunch too, is that the precepts are really just zazen. And I was curious, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I was curious if you had any like thoughts on that, because that was really interesting to me. And I really wanted to like understand what he means that the precepts are really just like telling us about zazen.
Well, Shohaku Okamura is one of my favorites. There, I have a lot of favorites though. And Mark is laughing. And I have no idea what they're talking about. Mark, do you have an idea of what they're talking about?
I could spin a theory, but let's say no.
I mean, zazen is what we're supposed to do. I mean, you know, this is it. Here's the big clue, if you're new, is that everything we read, it's all telling us to do zazen, okay? So, and one of the big things I get out of the Bendowa, which we are studying in our book group, is do zazen, take what you learned during zazen, and bring it into your everyday life once you get off the cushion. So I think of, again, this is the conventional way, I think of, as I have tried to work with the precepts, that I'm bringing them into my conventional life.
That's the best I could kind of piece together too. I really like how Rev Anderson uses the phrase like being upright a bunch in his book. And I think like the best clue I got from him is that like sitting zazen kind of like helps us understand the experience of kind of like everyone. And that kind of softens us to the experience of others. And it helps us understand, kind of like connect the precepts to compassion, I guess was the best that I could kind of fit.
Well, zazen can be a very humbling experience. In fact, it is a lot for me. And I think in that sense, it's teaching us compassion as I am learning. That's what the precepts are supposed to do. I mean, you will hear Domio say it a lot during precept study, compassion trumps everything. So it's more important to be compassionate about the person you're with or the situation you're in than it is to tell the truth necessarily. It's more important to be compassionate than it is to do any of the other precepts. But one of the things that I keep coming back to, which I think is so wonderful, and I believe Domio said this last week, or she said it to me personally when we met, but you know, if we let them, the precepts will work themselves, which I just think is amazing. Because, you know, I did take the pinball machine route and it's not comfortable. It's hard to stay on the straight and narrow because I can't do that and I can't do this and I'm not supposed to do that. They really are much more compassionate than that.
Jinru, this is Jeff. I'm thinking that for those that are learning about Jukai or maybe even considering Jukai, it might be nice to hear a little bit from you about what it meant to you to receive Jukai and whether you experienced some particular value or meaning in the public ceremony of Jukai.
I will answer that question, and I would like to hear from others as well. But Mark, were you going to say something else on the earlier topic?
Yeah. I was going to say for the record, I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing in delight at Amanda's awesome cat. The other one was the precepts is Zazen. One of the things that I really like, I think it's Eshin Rosetto. It might be somebody else also, though, describes the precepts as a description of enlightened behavior. And I like the idea that you could point a line straight back at Zazen from that, because in Zazen is practice realization, right? In Zazen, none of the dumb ideas that lead to unethical behavior are in force, right? Even if they're just drifting through, they're not enforced. So that was my thought on the Zazen as the precepts.
Thank you. To answer Jeff's question, and there are others I know who can answer it, and I'm hoping you will step up, because I think people need to hear this. I did not enter into precept to taking of the precepts out of fear that I would break them, because I knew I would. For me, it was like I knocked on the door and Domio opened it for me. And I think I had been at Brightway Zen and going pretty regularly for a year before I went through the Jukai ceremony. And what the ceremony meant for me in my journey was, okay, now what? Now I got to get to work. No more messing around and just maybe going on Tuesday and maybe popping in on Sunday. No going late and leaving early. Now I got to work. And because my spiritual path, I had one to begin with, and I particularly wanted to enrich it, and I thought Buddhism was the way. And I only got here 6 years ago, so I was not young. And I always have this sense of running out of runway. So I needed that ceremonial experience to push me forward and get me working on something, which is what it did. Jukai to this day is my favorite ceremony of all, and I have been involved, used to be involved in all of the ceremonies. This is my favorite, and I love the fact that we all do the precepts together. We all agree, I will. So it's a very, it's a really personal time for me as an individual, as well as for us as a Sangha. It's very human. Now I know somebody can add to that. And I will call on you.
I think I've said this in context of precept classes in the past, but there's something in Eshin Rosetto's book about precepts as warning lights on the dashboard of life. And I really like the precepts as instruments as dials and gauges and lenses and magnifying glasses. And I had a block against receiving the precepts as well, in part due to a previous religious tradition. And there came a year where I wanted to take the precepts and I chickened out at the end because something was making me hesitate. And then at the precept ceremony, I realized I'd made a mistake and I had to wait a year to take them again. But the thing that I realized with the precepts was that I was already committed to using whatever instruments I could get a hold of to examine my life and find the places where I was stuck. And the places where my own bad ideas were causing me to do harm. So for me, the relationship with the precepts was, I don't want to. Oh, wait, I already took them. Well, I might as well say the words. And so for me, it was an acknowledgement. Like, yes, this is, I'm for real about this. And yet it was still very powerful. I definitely got choked up when the Wagesa settled over my neck.
That's a very interesting comment. I remember as I was coming up to the weeks or weekends before Jukai, I remember, I don't know if it was a term student program I was in or if it was simply a Saturday retreat, but we did the robe chant. Was it the robe chant? I think it was. And the minute we started saying how great the robe of liberation, we did it together for some reason. I don't know why. But I felt something like somebody was putting a warm cloak around me. And if there had been any hesitation at all about whether I should do the precepts, it was gone. At that moment, it was gone. It was a great question, Jeff. Do you want to add anything to it? How many people took Jukai when you did? Do you remember?
Well, let's see. That was, I'm trying to remember what year that was. It was, I think, 2012. I think there was three or four of us, something like that. Don was a Jukai ceremony mate of mine. Shoketsu, did you take Jukai with me? I think you did. Yeah. I have very similar thoughts as you, Jinru, about the meaning of Jukai for me. If I could add anything and maybe reinforce something you said, I decided to show up for myself and to the Sangha, my Buddhist buddies, to show up in public saying, I'm going to be in this direction, I'm going to be in this place. It was a kind of declaration, a commitment, a lot of unknowns. Where exactly am I going? This journey looks a little uncertain. I'm not quite sure how to go about it, but I'm going to just do my best and show up in this way. And it's had great meaning for me, and I highly recommend it.
Did you want to add anything, Shoketsu?
Well, I just wanted to remind Jeff that we were of the first class, so to speak, of Domio's, first group of Domio's students to take Jukai. And that was a great honor. I was really enjoying the whole journey of learning about Buddhism and learning from her as a teacher and having colleagues like Jeff and Dawn. And there were a few others. I don't remember them all, but at the moment we have pictures. But yeah, it meant so much. And it was a declaration, a public declaration that I was going to embrace the precepts and really try to live by them. And it's not always easy, even to this day, it's still hard. I struggle with many of the precepts. But I'm so glad to have them. I'm so pleased to have them and have this Rakasu as a symbol of that, my robe.
Yes. Yeah, I really wanted to be able to say pretty simply, you know, I didn't want to say I'm a Buddhist and have somebody I'm talking to is, oh, meditation is so cool, man. I sit there and think all the time. You know, I wanted to be serious about it. I wanted people to know I really am a practicing Buddhist and I needed that ceremony and that Wagesa so that I could make that declaration. Time for more questions or comments.
Oh, I just want to say I love those stories, and I could hear more even if there's more people that have had those experiences. It's good. I've been coming to so many things and meeting people, but. This feels like it's really coming from the heart, and I'm enjoying that.
Well, I can share about when I took Jukai, which I think was 2016, so 5 years ago. And, you know, I was raised Catholic. I went to all Catholic school, and so very strong Catholic background and, you know, a lot of guilt. And I've been meditating on my own for quite a while, and then finally decided I need a Sangha. So came to Bright Way, and I had no hesitation about the precepts because to me, it was like, you know, these things that you make a commitment to do, you're the person that is responsible. You're not answering to the church or God or anybody. There's no guilt trip. It's just you. And to me, that was just so powerful and meaningful and felt so right that I had no hesitation. So
thank you.
I haven't taken Jukai yet, but I was at last year's ceremony, and the thing that really stuck out, it all stuck to me. It was a pretty powerful ceremony, but like the bit that really struck with me was how there's a line where each person going up to take the precepts, Domio tells them to tell the God where you were born what you are doing so that they will smile on you. And that just blew my mind because I'm also from that very conservative I'm sorry, it's very late for me. Not that late, but I'm a morning person. It's that conservative tradition that idea that you could accept these teachings and still honor the God of the place where you were born is a really interesting thing. Like that was a very new idea to me. And I think there's a lot of beauty in that, that acknowledgement that the Dharma is for everybody. And that if the Dharma, like how to tell if the Dharma is a good Dharma. There's a teaching from the Buddha about that. How do you assess if this is a good Dharma? And that struck me as being very powerful, that it is intended to be for everybody.
Were you actually there, Amanda, in person?
I wasn't in the park, no. I was watching on Zoom.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why we're delaying it just a little bit is because of the pandemic, so that if we in fact need to have it outside, we can. It's more likely that we can in June. But it will also be available, won't it, Bob, to people on Zoom? Well, I mean, we have that open to people on Zoom. Yeah, so even if you're not in the area and you want to take part, feel free, because it's really for everybody in the Sangha.
Two remote people took Jukai last year.
Say again?
Two people took Jukai remotely last year.
That's right. Adeen and I can't remember who else.
Claudia, I think.
Oh, Claudia, yeah. One more minute.
Thank you very much for your sharing, Jana or Jinryu. It was very wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. That's what's cool about the precepts, is you're definitely going to learn something, and you're going to learn something about yourself that you never knew. I don't do that. Oh, yes, I do. I do do that. Okay, so we offer the merit of this discussion and our being together tonight to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Shane, I have can answer you.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
Are you there?
Yep.
So you asked about the Rakusu?
Yeah.
This. What you do is when you first take the precepts, you get a Wagasa like Bob has. And then, you know, after a few years, if you decide to take an actual teacher, then you make a Rakusu, which is much more complicated. So I decided to take Domio as my teacher and took the precepts again, of course, during that time. And I take the precepts every year, but that's the difference between the strip of
the Wagasa.
Wagasa and the Rakusu, which both Jinryu and I have.
And that's the way it's done in our particular lineage.
Yeah. Right.
And in many other lineages, you have to make your own Rakusu before you can take the precepts.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah, I thought that was a part of the process.
Good night, Jeff.
Great. Can I ask one more question about that?
Sure.
How did you decide both, I mean, you can share or not share with the group, how did you decide that you wanted to have Domio as your teacher? What does that mean? What does that entail?
Well, you know, it's like everything else. I think it's probably very different for every individual. But in my own case, I had been doing some meditation in the Hindu sense, in the sense of yoga, the yoga tradition. And I wanted my own guru. I have always wanted my own personal spiritual advisor. So I came here knowing that I was ultimately going to be on that path. And yes.
Well, for me, Domio was the first person to introduce me to Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, and I sat with her for a year or two, and I just decided that I needed teaching, I needed a teacher, so I asked her. a big thing. You have to ask three times and all that to make sure you really want to do it. She makes sure that you really want to commit to it. And then you have to work on this thing, which is really complicated. But yeah.
Thank you for sharing. And then what do you do with the teacher versus, like, you know, when you go, I'm sure everybody's different. Like if I go and talk to her about something, what are you working on? Like your own koan, your own, you know, I don't know. I guess it just seems so free form, you know, where.
Yeah, it is free form. I meet with her occasionally. I don't do it as much as I used to. I used to meet with her every few weeks. Now, I don't know, I haven't much at all. So I need to get back on that. But I'm sure, Jinryu, you probably meet more often.
Actually, I don't. You know, I would see her more often because I worked with Curly so much. And right. Of course, the pandemic. I met with her last week for the first time in probably a couple of months. But to answer your question, it really is what you happen to be working on. And, you know, with me, sometimes it's a precept. Sometimes it's a situation in life. Sometimes, oh, I just heard this in the Sunday chant. I never knew it was there. What does this really mean for me? Kind of a discussion. And to this day, this is the truth. I never know what is okay to bring to Domyo in a sansen. I still don't know. So I think it doesn't matter.
I hear you. Because even just when the member meeting, like to meet with her, and I would like ask other Sangha members, I'd be like, what do you ask her? What are you doing in these meetings? And it was just like, yeah, whatever. Or I remember Richard saying, yeah, I kind of go in there thinking I'm going to talk about this. And then he goes in and he talks about something totally different. So it's just okay. So I'm glad that there's this unclear.
It's all okay.
It's all okay. Isn't that the way, right? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. And thanks for being here.
Take care.
Yeah, thank you.
Good night, everybody. Good morning, Ken.